the way that doing my dad's bucket list was something I was doing for him, I think it was telling that true story. I think it was giving him an accurate portrayal, at least from my eyes. You know, obviously we don't know all, so we can't tell the full truth. We can only tell our truth. But I did it with compassion and with a shared humanity. And I really think once we pass, we can have some unfinished business here. And what a blessing if there's people here who still love us so much that they want to help us complete that unfinished business.
This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place, the heart of the story. Oh, my friends, you are going to want to listen to today's episode. Today, I spoke with author and journalist Laura Carney. Laura is the author of the memoir, My Father's List, which is all about finding her father's bucket list after he had passed away and fulfilling all of the items on that list, which led to not only great adventures, but profound understanding of her father and of herself. This conversation was incredible. We connected on a really surprising level that I didn't anticipate. As you know, I lost my father in April of 2021. He was 57 years old, and I lost him to cancer. And I haven't really spoken openly about the ways that I communicate with him still, now that more than 4 years have passed, and how and when I feel his presence, and also the complications that divorce and other things contributed to our relationship, and how I've grown to really, really understand and appreciate him so much in these last several years as I've reflected back and really discovered more of who he was, parts that I didn't even really know when he was alive. And so, gosh, Laura got it all out of me somehow. And we talked about just really surprising discoveries and ways that our fathers have communicated with us after their passing that surprised us. And so it shocked me to kind of open up in this way. And I know that it will be really moving and powerful for you. I think that Father's Day is a day that can be both celebratory and difficult and everything in between. And that's why I wanted to have Laura on today, because we talk about it all, the good, the bad, and the miraculous, I guess. This was a big surprise, my friends. So you'll just have to listen to find out more about what I'm talking about. Here is my conversation with Laura Carney. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know that you and I have had somewhat similar experiences in terms of events around our fathers. And I just feel like kindred spirits and am really happy to chat with you today, especially about how we carry on a father's legacy. And so I would love for you to start off by just sharing with listeners the story that led to the writing of your book.
Sure. Well, my book is called My Father's List, How Living My Dad's Dream Set Me Free. And it's about my 6-year journey to complete the bucket list of my late father, who died when I was 25 years old in a distracted driving car crash. A teenager was lost and made a phone call at a red light, ran through the next red light, and he was turning left. I spent about 13 years not really knowing what to do with that grief and with the anger I felt over what happened to him. And for me, that incident sort of combined with this notion of like a rude awakening to the real world. You know, like, oh, okay, this is what life is. And it was interesting because I actually had been diagnosed with depression as a teenager. And I remember when this happened thinking like, oh, now I have something extremely serious to be upset about. It's not like an internally created sadness that I'm experiencing. It's rather like just something outside of me. Also almost feeling like it was a little bit too much because basically when I was in college, the year before, I had been placed on as many as like 9 to 13 antidepressants in 1 year.
Wow.
And had to go to a hospital to get off all of them. Then just after that, I moved to New York for an internship. I met the man who would be my later husband. And then this happened 3 months later. My husband actually met my dad 5 days before he died.
Wow.
So I remember at the time feeling like I was living in a movie.
Yeah.
Because there's so many crazy things were happening. Mm-hmm. And I also then made the decision not to go back to Delaware, where I was from. We decided that I should stay in New York because my dad wouldn't want me to give up on my dreams on becoming a journalist. Mm-hmm. So I sort of just like survived that time. And then I started getting jobs. And then around the time I was 35, that was when my husband proposed. And it was like something was sort of happening to me. It was mm-hmm. like, I thought when I was 25, after the initial shock and sadness of my father's death sort of dissipated, oh, now I have to make sure I have a really good life because I have to prove that I'm okay. Like I almost had this very strange embarrassment response, which I guess isn't that weird if you're a teenager who had depression and I was still sort of carrying that almost like a chip on my shoulder that I had about that.
Yeah.
So I instead of like processing the grief in a healthy way and actually like talking about it with people, you know, there were two things happening. One, I didn't want to be seen as a victim of something. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't express it like that, except with my boyfriend who would later become my husband.
Yeah.
Two, I didn't know who I could talk to about it because everyone I knew who knew my dad was similarly shocked by what happened. And it was like such a family tragedy that it was like nobody really wanted to go there, if that
yeah.
makes sense. Like we were all coping with that, even as brothers. So I really turned what could have been something that I was expressing in a group or sharing with other people into my own personal plight. And I kept it inside. And then when it came time for my wedding to happen, it was like everything exploded, basically, mm-hmm. because now I had to move forward in life. And now I'm crossing a threshold that my father was supposed to be there for.
Yes.
And he was supposed to help me do, and he's not. And I'm, you know, I worked in women's magazines. Like that was what my dream was, to write for magazines. And I particularly loved women's magazines. I had been really successful. You know, I was a copy editor, which isn't the most glamorous job in magazines, but I had actually made it there. So I was working it for Good Housekeeping magazine, very long hours. That's just the nature of copy editing. You wait until everybody's done with their writing and then yeah. you're there and you do it. But I didn't care. Like I worked my butt off at that job because I was just so grateful to be there. But I also had this notion, I think, that the harder I worked and the more I could climb the ladder, the better I was going to feel about these terrible things that had happened when I was 25. And that just wasn't happening. Like I wasn't feeling better. You know, like I could find joy in my life. But, you know, the main thing that was suffering was my creativity. Mm. When I was in college, first I was an art major, then I dated a journalist, and that's when I switched my major. But as soon as I switched, I sort of just became this, like, extremely productive writer overnight. Like, I just had a million ideas, and I was, yeah. like, the runner-up for an award, and I loved it. I was always coming up with ideas for stories. But then as soon as my dad died, suddenly no ideas.
Yeah.
For like a decade. I went like that. And
yeah.
So one day I was at work around the year I was 35, and an article came across my desk about distracted driving. Mm-hmm. And I had not made the connection that it had been the distraction from the phone that had created the situation that was like a perfect storm that led to her to not see the red light. And I started working with those groups. I started speaking in high schools. I started learning more about that. And at first, what I used my platform for was promoting the other people.
Yeah.
I had a friend of the Washington Post. So I would get someone's story in the Washington Post for them, basically, or I would help them edit their story. And I remember at the time telling my future husband, because we were just engaged then, this is what I'm supposed to do with my life. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I was supposed to help people express themselves and tell their stories, because that's what I learned how to do in college. Then eventually it started occurring to me, like, well, maybe I'm supposed to tell my story.
Mm-hmm.
And which was the scariest thing to do, because I just felt like this was so personal. It was so tragic. It's still not resolved for me.
Yeah.
I don't know how to tell this story, and I don't want to go there. I didn't want to go there in my head, because I had, you know, we filed things away in a certain way. But I started making myself do that. And it started with articles. I had some articles in the Washington Post and in Runner's World. And then we got married. And I remember when I walked down the aisle thinking to myself, you know, at least I'm not a victim, because I have become a journalist with this. I have written about the problem, like scientifically speaking, what happens to the brain that made that teenager do that day. And in that sense, I've taken some agency in what happened, and I've turned it into something positive in my life, because I'm a journalist and I deal with things in a scientific way.
Yeah.
I had convinced my magazine that I worked at, Good Housekeeping, to publish a feature on distracted driving.
Yeah.
So when I walked down the aisle, I just felt like almost like the power had come back to me and no one had taken him away, and I was doing something with it. But then when I got home from the wedding, I saw the statistics for distracted driving, the fatal crashes caused by it, and they had only gotten higher.
Yeah.
Basically, in the year that I, since I'd become an activist. And
yeah.
I just thought, God, what am I doing wrong? being like brand new at it. Like, what needs to change? What needs to happen so that people start just taking this a little bit more seriously and understanding that it's real? I always thought, like, you know, how is this different from drunk driving? I used to compare it to people in the 60s finally learning that smoking caused cancer.
Right.
It was like a thing everybody did. But it's like, no, this actually does kill some people. It's kind of akin to that. So I just racked my brain. What needs to happen differently? How can I tell this story differently? How can other people tell this story differently? Like, what does the government need to do? And then we were visiting my brother at his new house. And he told me that he found something when he was moving. And it turned out to be our father's bucket list, which neither of us ever knew about. And our mom did, but my parents divorced when I was 6. So she didn't know that my dad had kept it, and he had kept doing it his whole life. He wrote it when he was 29, the year I was born. And it was one of these moments where it was like, you just know that's the choice you have to make. Previously to that time, I'm actually a very intuitive person, but I leaned really heavy on my analytical side. And I thought of myself as like, I only take cautious risks, you know, like, I wouldn't just make a very emotional, intuitive decision. Only a few times in my life had I done that. But when we saw this, something lit up inside of me. And I saw my dad's face in the back of my head, just smiling and nodding. And my husband said, Laura, this is your book.
Oh, so many things.
That's where it comes from.
Yes. You covered so much ground in the sharing of that, because so many of the women who listen are writers and aspiring writers, and they find themselves in all the different stages that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. First, it's like, okay, I'm going to do this one kind of writing that's maybe not my own story, but I'm just going to write and write and write and write, and hopefully it'll fill a gap. And then there's this little nagging voice that comes up like, you need to write about this. And we shush it for quite a while, most of us. And yet it still hangs out there. And when you were talking about, I thought if I just like worked hard enough and kept working that maybe these bad feelings would go away. And I think that so many women can identify with this and with the period of creative drought too that arises. So all of these things are things that the women that I coach experience. But I myself was just nodding along as you were talking about that, because for years and years, I was a fiction writer and thought like, my life couldn't possibly be interesting enough to write about. And then my husband and I experienced infertility, and I had an emergency surgery that was really traumatic. And I was at a writing retreat one time, and the host of the retreat said, you need to write about that experience. And it was right in front of me, but I was so baffled by it and had been helping other women share their stories, but thought, what could I possibly write about this? And do I have the courage to? And oh no, that's deeply personal. And So thank you for sharing such a relatable journey, because I think that so many people listening can identify. So you find this list and you get kind of the nod, and share with the listeners some of the very interesting points on that list. What did the list consist of? Because that's what lit me up when I first read what was on the list. Very interesting things.
Sure. I do want to add one thing. Also, I'm really sorry that that happened to you. And mm-hmm. I'm happy that you found your way through it with writing.
Yeah.
But one thing that was running through my mind while you were saying that just now was, I think the reason we struggle with that stuff is because we think we're supposed to be something despite what happened to us. When the answer lies in, we're supposed to be something because of it.
That's beautiful.
So if something unexpected and tragic happens to you, it's like, you don't just carry on and say, well, I'm going to still follow through with what my plans were. And this thing isn't going to define me. No, it's like, that's everything that is happening to you in your life is a gift. It's being given to you. It just doesn't look that way at first. But so the things on the list, you know, the thing that stood out to me at first was item 12, which said he hoped to give his children the best education, the best example, and the most love he could give. That one really made me tear up. And then the next one I noticed that I had an emotional reaction to was sing at my daughter's wedding. Because that had just happened and my brother was about to get married himself. The other ones, one I thought was definitely doable was run 10 miles straight because I had just run the New York Marathon, because I decided planning a wedding wasn't stressful enough and I needed to
just add a little bit on top. To
the mix. No, it was just the timing. I became an activist, and inherent in my activism was running. So I would raise money for the different activists with running, and it just sort of kept going. I went from half 5K 1 year, the next year half marathon, the next year marathon. And actually, I think it helped. I joke about it, but I think it helped with my wedding planning because I had this incredibly focusing discipline I had developed, and it was helping me cope with stress. And
yeah,
I recommend running to anybody. Anyway, so I thought, well, that's the first one I'll do because I already am a runner anyway. I had just signed up to do the LA marathon. And since it said run 10 miles straight, I figured my dad meant, you know, he probably meant like a full 10 because he wasn't, I don't recall him being a runner really. He always had kind of carried a couple extra pounds, even though he was a basketball player and like an athlete. He was very athletic when he was younger. So I had to make it harder for myself since I was already a runner. And I said, well, it's not just a full 10, it's 10 straight, no walking. Because I would always walk just like a little bit. So I had already signed up for the LA Marathon, and I thought, well, I'll just run the full first 10, and then I'll run and walk the remaining 16.2, which my best friend who lived out there in LA thought was completely crazy. And she's like, you're just going to be so tired after you put all of your energy into running 10. And then I found out that I could actually, if I was raising money for charity while running, which is what I normally did, I could split it with another person.
Well, at what point did you decide to, you see the list and you know that you can write about this, but at what point did you decide, you know what, I'm going to do all the items on this list?
Simultaneously. Yes. I mean, that's where I just immediately go into like, here's the first one I did. Yeah. That's really what it felt like. My brother is about to get married like within a week or 2 weeks, I think it was. I took the list home as soon as I saw it. Like I said, I just lit up and I was like, oh, we have to do this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't think it was going to be just me ever. Like, mm-hmm. I just assumed other people were going to help me. You know, luckily my husband is like, you know, yeah, let's do this. Like, so I assumed my husband was going to help me. And I immediately knew this is the book. My dad is giving me the chapters. My dad was a writer.
Yeah.
It was the first real experience of what felt like communication with his spirit for me. Although, you know, for years I kept seeing the number 88 because he died on August 8th. Mm. And it was happening a lot. And at one point when I was around 26 or so, I remember being at Penn Station in New York in the bathroom and just being like, okay, is this just you saying hi? Let's just say that's what it is. So from that point forward, whenever I would see an 88, which once in a while I would go through a few days where there would be like a lot of them, I would just think, okay, well, that's him. Or, you know, my dad was a singer and I always associate music with him. So I would hear songs that reminded me of him, like at very opportune moments, mm-hmm. you know, that was the extent of it. It wasn't, I see his face in my head, you know, it wasn't like what started happening when I started doing the list was I would hear two or three word phrases that were coming from him. And at first I was like, am I losing my mind? Because you know, I don't hear voices. Like, I have depression, but I'm okay. Like, like, someone who hears, you know, I don't have invisible friends. And suddenly I'm hearing Changing History or Just Play Ball. You know, when I finally did run the marathon in LA, and what ended up happening with that was my best friend who lives out there, who wasn't a runner at all, decided to join me. So we could split the distance, but she did the first half and I did the second half. And by the time I got to the end, and I didn't think I was going to make it that full 10 miles, I just was getting so tired. I had to go to the bathroom the whole time. I was like peeing my pants. But towards the end, I started having these thoughts of like what I recognized was I was now processing feelings I had about my dad while he was alive, which was you weren't a person who finished things. You know, and my fear that I was also that way, that I had inherited this. Like I had worked my butt off trying to be this extremely conscientious, had it all together person because I was trying to prove that I was not that way.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that the whole time I was doing that, I was actually denying the creative side of me because the creative side of me needed room to play and needed space to do things as it saw fit. So really getting to do this list, because it was so different, it was like an extra in my life. It was like this experiment I never expected. So now that I'm doing this, that person who I really am is getting a chance to come out and show who she is. So with the phrase I heard as I was reaching the end of those 10 miles and I'm having these gremlins show up in my head of, oh my God, you had so many crazy ideas when you were alive and you never saw them through. And now I'm being just like you and I'm not going to see this through. And just all of this, like everyone's going to laugh at me, you know, this frustration. I heard your life, your choices. And I heard it over and over and over on a loop. And it was like he was saying to me, because now I'm like convinced this is him, you know, I'm not like questioning anymore. But it felt to me like what he was saying was, hey, I didn't tell you to do this bucket list. like this is your idea.
This was all your grand scheme, my friend.
So stop blaming me for this. That's crazy. I didn't tell you to do this. If you want to do this, though, it's going to be about you. It's going to be the things that you need, and who you are is going to come out. Like, that's sort of, I mean, it wasn't that detailed at the time, but that's, but now I realize that's what it was. Because as I went through these 54 list items, which ran the gamut from, you know, skydive at least once. He had a very poetic way of saying these things. Swim the width of a river, ride a horse fast, go sailing by myself, talk with the president, correspond with the Pope, help my spouse feel, the way he put it was, make Joan feel pretty happy, healthy, and young every day of her life, which was my mom. So I applied that to my husband.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he had these very sweet goals in addition to more like thrill seeking ones.
Yeah.
One of them was grow a watermelon. You know,
yes, that was one of my favorites. But before, because I have so many questions about some of the items list, but before we get to that, what I appreciate about in the book, but also you as you're talking now, is the truth about the complicated feelings we have about our parents, even if they've passed, because we oftentimes, when someone passes away, we will make them into angels who were never human and were never complex people. Mm-hmm. As you know, you and I have talked about this, but my father passed away in 2021 at the age of 57 from lung cancer. And I was a child of divorce, and we had partial custody, and I only saw him on Sundays. And when I was younger, the truth is he really did not know what to do with me. And now as a parent, I have so much grace and so much compassion for him. But back then when I was little, you know, he would pick me up on a Sunday, we would go back to my grandma's house and he would work on his computer. And then he would drop me back off at home hours later. But then when I became an adult, it's like he looked at me and all of a sudden he could relate. And he was like, oh, okay, we're good now. And that is when our relationship took off. And so when he passed, I had all manner of feelings. I mm-hmm. had lots of feelings about the complicated relationship he had had with my mom. I had lots of feelings about feeling not fully seen or loved by him as a child, and then deep gratitude for the adult years that we did have together. So I appreciate that about you walking us through all of the feelings that came up, say, like when you were running, and the communication that you had with him. Because after my father passed away, I didn't expect to be in any sort of spiritual communication because when I was younger, we were so distant. So I thought of all the people that who have passed in my life, I didn't think his voice would be the strongest. And after he passed away, every day I would go for a run on this one hill, and there would be a deer, the same deer, waiting for me every morning at the like shoulder of the road. First morning, you know, I'm like, oh, beautiful deer. Second morning, I was like, hey there. Third morning, I was like, is that you? I mean, on and on it goes. And then I'm laughing to myself as I'm running, because my husband and I would joke, my father's name was Jerry, and we'd be like, oh, hey, Jerry. You know, it's just like so normal. It became so normal. And I was like, I cannot say this out loud. I feel like people will laugh in my face. But then there would be certain times when I would meditate that his voice would come through so strongly in a way I never could imagine or create, even though I've been a fiction writer. Like, he and my grandmother would come through very clearly and in the way they were in real life, like in this very sort of jokey, like would go from serious to jokey all in an instant. And I would be like, oh my God. But again, I was so afraid to say it out loud. The only person I would tell is my husband. And I would dictate sometimes what would come through, because I'm like, mm-hmm. you're not going to believe this. And one time, finally, I came in from a meditation. I had meditated outside and I had tears streaming down my face. And my husband's like, what happened? I read him verbatim what I had just heard. His eyes start tearing up and he was like, you can't make that shit up. So it feels so good to relate to someone else. So back to your list, all these beautiful things on the list.
Can I comment on that really quick? I mean, just the way you described it is exactly how it happens, how it's supposed to happen. There's an urgency to it.
Mm.
That's how you get to tell the difference. Because if you just have a thought and it's your voice. When you hear something come through and that's not your voice, like that's not how I talk, that's not how I think. And it is like, there's this urgency of you need to hear this right now. Mm-hmm. You need to write this down right now. So that's how you know that it's real.
Mm. Well, that feels very true.
I just want to make sure you knew that.
Yeah, it feels very, very true. And like you say, these little phrases that would come through mm-hmm. and it's just like, what is happening?
That's how spirit talks. Yeah.
Mm.
A few word phrases oftentimes in like, what's the word for it? I can't think of what the word for it is. Idioms, I think.
Yeah. Or aphorisms. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. But go on. You were saying about the list.
Yeah. So you have all these interesting things, like what I saw, the letter to a pope and grow a watermelon. And then you have on Instagram and elsewhere, like these beautiful pictures, like a little watermelon in your palm and things like yeah. that. What did the list teach you about your dad? And what did it teach you about you?
Oh, gosh. My dad was very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
He was very intentional. He was a very well-read person, which I knew, but I think he was really well-versed in the law of attraction.
Mm.
I found a pledge that he wrote to himself at the age of 22. I know because he wrote, that was the title at the top of the notebook paper.
Mm.
Pledge to self at the age of 22.
Very distinct.
He was very dramatic. I can hear him in my head right now saying, like, I'm the dramatic one. I am also very dramatic. I have a flair for drama. It was in the spirit of Napoleon Hill, he wrote on it. And I didn't know who Napoleon Hill was, but when I discovered this notebook, and this happened throughout the whole list journey, I kept finding more things.
Mm.
And it was always felt to me like they were showing up at the most opportune time.
Yeah.
So when I first started writing the book in year one of doing the list, that's when his outlines for his book showed up
mm-hmm.
in a notebook, you know, and I can't remember at this moment when the pledge to self showed up, but it freaked me out because when I was 26, on the anniversary of his death, I wrote a pledge to myself.
Mm.
Very similar, although I didn't know who Napoleon Hill was. Basically, I was discovering things about him that I was like, mm. that I had inherited. And that yeah. was a big part of my healing. And I think, I'd imagine you can probably relate to this because it sounds almost like you had a similar experience with your dad, with your mom being your primary caregiver.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was like, you know, I didn't know the whole story of why they had divorced when I was really young, but I think sometimes when we're little kids and we don't know the whole story, we just sort of piece it together.
Yeah.
And like we invent our own story. So my story that I invented, which has nothing to do with reality, was, oh, my dad is really fun and my mom's more practical and that's why this didn't work out. So I better try to be more fun. I was like telling myself. And you know, which is crazy. Like, they're both fun. Like, that's not what happened. But that was my childlike view of things. But also, my mom is steady and secure and can provide for us. And my dad seemed like not always able to do that.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the story I was telling. You know, not, oh, my dad is a super intelligent, creative person who had really great intentions for his life. And maybe they just didn't come true the way he wanted them to.
Mm.
And he's actually kind of a dissatisfied creative person. And that was closer to the truth.
Mm.
And I would say the main thing about him that changed for me as I was doing this was, I had this notion that giving in to your creativity and being someone who makes things was selfish,
mm.
that it was self-centered, that that's not real work. You know, the real work is you go to your job or you take care of your family, mm. you know, or you make a secure living. That's real work.
Mm.
I didn't understand that for people who are meant to be creative, meant to make things, I mean, art is extremely important, art is what helps us process the more difficult, you know, things that happen in life. And we undervalue it. And for the person whose role in society it is to make that art, they need certain parameters in order to make it. Yeah. And they need, most of all, freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom to explore who they are. And my dad needed that because that's who he was.
Yeah.
And I developed just a whole new level of respect for that. A better concept of, oh, he was reading people like Napoleon Hill because he was trying to understand himself better.
Yeah.
And he was trying to learn how to harness this because he knew he had something. And that finally was like just a big moment for me because I started to understand, oh, I got it. Like, that's why I have struggled my whole life to fit in. Like, there are so many parts of me that for so long I thought there's something wrong with being this way because it was different.
Yeah.
But no, it's actually, there were so many parts of me that were like, when I was doing the list, they were helpful.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, in addition to being diagnosed with depression, I was diagnosed with ADHD as a teenager. But as I'm doing the list, I'm starting to see for the first time, oh my God, having ADD is so helpful because I can go from like training to run 10 miles straight to planning how I'm going to have an article about this in Good Housekeeping, which would satisfy have my picture in a national magazine, you know, to going to getting an agent for publishing a book. And that's going to satisfy number three, right? And have a few novels published. You know, like I had these 54 things. And I was able to maintain 2, 3, or 4 of them at one time in my brain and plan the different pieces of it. And it was like, oh, as a kid, I was taught having ADD means you need high stimulation. And that means there's something wrong with you because you're different. But now I had like so much stimulation and I was thriving.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I need that to feel normal.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I'm wrong. It just means this is how I'm wired. And that's actually a good thing. And then even writing the book, you know, like I went into that thinking, oh, I've written essays and I've published articles. I just don't know if I can write a book. Like, it's just so long. And then once I finally got into doing it and started seeing it as the puzzle that it is and developing habits around it that I needed to have in order to get it done, I started to understand, no, this is just an endurance sport. This is like running a marathon. Mm-hmm. And actually I am very well equipped for this. Like I can work for 6 or 8 hours straight and I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And that again is ADD. That's my hyper-focus. So basically I started to see the things I saw as deficits in my dad as gifts. And then I started seeing that in myself as well.
Yes, 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 yes. I had many similar experiences of getting a much deeper understanding of my father after his passing. The story that I had told to myself about my father was that he was a lone wolf. He never remarried. He never had any other children. I thought he was a workaholic because he just worked a lot. And because it had been a volatile relationship between him and my mom, I wondered about the demons that lurked inside of him. After his passing, I began to understand him much more deeply. Like, I was like, oh, well, you love the work that you do, and it could entertain you for hours. Maybe he liked being alone, actually. Like, I had been throwing him a pity party that he had been alone for many years, and I thought, you love your own company. You go away regularly on your own. And maybe he very much enjoyed his own company. And maybe you're even a little like him. And so there were these moments of, oh, I would look back and think about the different trips we went on when I was an adult. And how he would meticulously plan them out. I have these images of him. We went to Ireland when I was in my 20s as a big family trip. And at night in the little cottage that we had rented, he would be up with brochures and everything just like, and he would be writing an itinerary so that the next day we would have this like great adventure. And while he was not an affectionate man or a man that said out loud very much like, I love you, I was like, oh, trip planning was his love language. And guess who else does that a lot? And so it was just all these moments where I didn't connect the pieces, or I didn't put together the puzzle until after his death. And I began to see, it was almost like decoding my DNA. It was like, oh, this is who he was. This is who you are. Here's how you're similar. And the more compassion and grace I had for him, the more I had for myself. And it seems like that was a similar experience for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so happy that you're able to figure out a way to do that mm-hmm. because, you know, for a couple of reasons. One, I think as women, we tend to be attracted to men who have some similarities to our fathers. Mm. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case for you. I don't know your partner, but that was the case for me. And I needed to find out, you know, what did I really love about my dad and make that the story for me. Not I was robbed of something, mm-hmm. not even just when he died young, but rather also when he left when I was six. And there were so many mysteries that surrounded him that I didn't understand. If I continued to be resentful or bitter or telling the story of I didn't get what I was supposed to get,
yeah,
that's going to have an impact on my relationship.
Yeah.
And how I view whatever my husband might be, how he might be treating me. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is when you are able to reframe the story and figure out for yourself, what did I think of this parent? Because I think when there's a divorce, it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah.
It's difficult to parse out, what do I think of my mom? What do I think of my dad? Or, you know, for people who have two moms or two dads, what do I think of this parent or that parent? You automatically just start incorporating, well, what does this parent think of them?
Yeah. Yep.
What does my mom think of my dad? What does my dad think of my mom? Why didn't this work out? So it gets kind of intermingled, even in the best circumstances, because my parents did a fantastic job mm-hmm. of protecting us from their adult issues. But I couldn't separate it because I just wanted to know what happened. And I was viewing my dad through this lens, not just of my experiences of him, but what do I think other people think of him? What yeah. do I think my mom thinks, and et cetera. And that, if I continued on that way, I was never going to process the grief.
Yeah.
I was never going to let myself feel the missing that I felt. And I was never going to own what he was to me. And a big part of that was because most of my experiences with him were very isolated. Mm. So there isn't any real reference or validation. I can't go to my uncles and be like, oh yeah, I remember how dad was like this. Because yeah. I mean, to be totally honest, one of my uncles, after the book launch, he came to it and he told me that night, until he met me as an adult and read my book, and he had just started reading the book and heard me talk about my dad, he had no concept of my father as a father.
Mm. Yeah.
He just didn't know. And that was so affirming for me when I heard him say that. So I thought, okay, well, now I understand why he felt like a secret. And I just had to piece together for myself who this person was. And ultimately, that's why in the end, what I decided to do with the book was not interview people who knew him.
Yeah.
And instead just make it my own perspective on him as a father, and my own communication with him that was happening in present day while doing his list, and my own memories of him, because I wanted it to be as true as possible to, you know, what is that experience if you're a child of divorce and your father dies? Like, what is that? And what does that feel like for the daughter going through that? So that's really why I did it. But again, like, it's so important to figure out your own sense. Who was this person? Who were they to me?
That is huge. It is huge. Like, as you were speaking, my whole heart opened up, because my mom, I kept from me for years that my father had been abusive to her. But I think she was very watchful. Anytime I would go on a Sunday with him, when I would come back, she would, how did it go? You know, she was always fishing to make sure he never lost his temper with me. And later on in my late teens, I learned that that was the reason for their divorce. And so, of course, you can't help but then have that bit of information and look at a person and realize mm-hmm. that was a part of him. And so
you knew about that before he died?
I did. Okay. And then when, you know, I was an adult, as we got closer and closer, I was able to start really seeing that all humans are complex and it's no excuse for the behavior at all. But I also got to see that there were other parts to my father. And that was one part. And there were many, many parts to him. And I just got to see him as a fully fleshed out human beyond the 19-year-old military guy that my mom had married, and with his own traumas and baggage and whatnot. And so after his passing, you know, I was thinking a lot about my own experience with him separate from that, because he never lost his temper with me. He was gruff once and like a little short tempered in verbally. And I was like, oh, it gave me a little window. But that was it. That was the extent to it going there. But when he passed, there were a couple of relatives who were very, very greedy and came forth and were talking about all that he had owed to them. And at first, that really bothered me and kind of tainted my own experience of him. And so again, I had to go through the work of distinguishing who he was to me, period, end stop. Not his experience with other people, but what were the experiences that I had. And also, when I looked back through like pictures that he had in his house of like his whole life, I was also able to see a joyous side to him that most people didn't see, because he would often come across, at least in the workplace, as a more serious person and maybe a bit more reserved socially. But when you really got to know him, as I knew him and my relatives in Ireland knew him, like he had a super funny sarcasm to him and this joy. And so when I looked at pictures and I thought back to memories, I was able to resurface that and see him as the complex, multifaceted being that he was and who he was to me. So I think that's a beautiful point for anyone experiencing a loss of not who that person was to anyone else besides you.
And you said Ireland. I think our dads are friends. So his last name was Kenny then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. The Kennys and the Carneys were surely neighbors.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. County Kerry is where.
County Kerry. Okay.
Yeah.
What part of Ireland? Is that the more southern?
Yeah.
Of Ireland?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, you guys probably had the, what's it called? What's the stone you kiss? The Blarney Stone.
The Blarney Stone. Oh my gosh. And in fact, total aside here. Keep talking to you, but it's so funny about the Blarney Stone, because one of my happiest memories happened there. So on this trip to Ireland, I'm 22. My father says, I'm going to take you and your aunt and cousin and grandma and grandpa, we're going to go to Ireland. You're going to meet your Irish cousins and aunts and uncles. And I'm like, all right. You know, I was in grad school. I was like, let's do it. I was like, hey, if I get to come along for this ride, cool. So we go on this trip. We all stay in a house together. So I'm really getting to know him on a deeper level and then my relatives on a deeper level. And so we say, all right, we're going to take a trip to the Blarney Castle. All right, fine. So we're always waiting on my grandfather. My grandfather had worked the night shift his whole life. So he was like a night owl. And so like we'd be in the rental car ready to go at 10 a.m. and grandpa would not be up yet. And we're like, oh my gosh. So my father says to my grandpa, who we're always giving my grandpa a hard time, but like, hey, you got to be ready at 10, like, and be ready to like climb the castle stairs. The Blarney Stone is up at the top. Like you got to get moving.
That doesn't sound like a military guy at all.
I know, not at all. So my grandfather comes out of the house in his usual outfit, which was like dress pants and like slick-soled shoes, like dress shoes, like old man would. Pockets full of change and pocket knives and everything else. And my father's like, whatever, let's get in the car. We go to the castle. My father, my aunt, my cousins, and I, and my grandma, we all make it up the stairs. We all lean back and we kiss the stone. We're standing on this top level. I mean, it's a busy, packed day. And we're like, why isn't anyone else coming up? the stairs. And where is Grandpa? 20 minutes later, you see my grandfather like slowly emerging from the narrow castle stairs. The stairs were so narrow, it's a single file line. So because he was slipping with his shoes, he couldn't climb the stairs well. Like, he was very out of shape. Behind him is a line of angry tourists, like miles long. He had held up the whole line. He goes to lean back to kiss the Blarney Stone. Change has fallen out of his pockets. The pocket knife's fallen out. All this stuff's going everywhere. It's a mess. My grandma laughs so hard, she pees her pants. She has to wrap a sweatshirt around her waist. My father is like, here we go with the pockets. And we're all just like, same face, same freckled, like big-cheeked face, laughing, crying together. And that was when I felt the most bonded with my father and the Kenny side of my family. It was just like this moment of like eye roll, sarcasm, silliness.
Yeah, that's not a coincidence that that story emerged in this conversation. And that is, were your grandparents, so then they were visiting Ireland as well?
Yeah, they had come to the U.S. when they were like 18, 19. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your dad was like including them on the trip.
As a way to see their relatives. So yeah, again,
Ireland was not on my dad's bucket list. London and Paris were, but we made sure we swung by Ireland when we went to London. And I really, that was when I felt, I think, the most connected to him doing the bucket list thing. Because I got to go find where the Carneys were from.
Yes.
And there was just something... there's something ineffable about it, like just this feeling of connection to a place. It was real too, though, because I remember being in Dublin and my husband's like, everyone looks like you here.
Yeah.
I'm going to lose you.
Yes.
I won't be able to find your face in the crowd. I did belong there in that way. But also there was just something about, there's a certain Irish humor.
Yes.
There's a certain temperament that they have. It's like a sarcasm, but not quite, because it's not negative. It's just like, it's like they're playing with you.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yes,
it's like there's a wit to it, and it's just a playfulness, and it's so endearing. And that's how every person we met was there.
Yes.
And that's how my father was, and that's how I am to some degree. It's how my brother is. It's like the whole Carney family, we each have it. My cousins have it too.
Yes.
And then like the gift of gab, just the long stories, you know, like,
yes,
there's a musical quality to the people there. And that was one of my favorite parts of the journey of the bucket list, was learning about Yeats. So we got to go to Yeats's tower and Oscar Wilde, you know, just these Irish writers who's, there's just some connection there between them and my father's spirit, and really embracing these are my people, you know, like this is where I'm from. And there's something about that I think was like, I don't think I even realized it until this moment. It was a foundation for me in this grief that had no place this whole time. That's the way I can explain it. It had no place.
Yes.
And that's due to the divorce. Not just the divorce, though, because some people get divorced and they move on and have other families and they move on with their lives. But there was part of me that was convinced that something in my dad's life was never quite the same after that divorce. My father was a closeted crossdresser.
Yeah.
He performed in drag. My mom discovered it when I was 6. And it was too difficult to maintain that. Because he needed to keep two separate lives. And I totally understand. I have so much compassion for my mom going through that. I think if it were my husband and he said, I can't ever tell you where I'm going or what I'm doing, I wouldn't be able to do it either.
Right.
But they were incredible co-parents. And it was, you know, it was just a sad thing that happened. And that's why I just perceived it as sad. Mm-hmm. I saw them both being sad, and an unfortunate result of the fact that they felt they needed to hide this from us. And I totally understand why they felt they needed to do that. My mom told me when I was 18, because I kept seeing leftover makeup on my dad, and just was asking a lot of questions about it. So I knew for 7 years and never talked to him about it before he died. But I think he knew that I knew. And it's funny, my mom thinks that she told him, that she told me, but isn't it funny how like, oh, I don't remember.
Yes.
That would be helpful information, but she doesn't remember, but that's okay. That's just how our brains work. But when I learned that information, when I was 18, I internalized that as, oh, my dad is dishonest, or, oh, my dad is selfish, because I already thought he was a little selfish because he's so creative and he's always going after his dreams as opposed to being the one who's here in the house taking care of us.
Yeah.
But when I found that out, I was like, oh, wait, so there's all these people who know him differently than I do, who he performs with, who he's friends with, who I don't know. It's a whole other life, like Batman or something.
Yeah.
I took that very personally and was angry about it for a long time until I developed a better understanding that this was probably a part of who he was, that he could not understand himself very well.
Yeah.
And did the best he could to compartmentalize, because he did not want my brother or I to have to try to understand it. And I'm grateful to him for that. And I also have a great deal of sympathy for how difficult that had to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we're talking about how do you grieve for someone you feel like you didn't totally know, you just have to pick up those pieces and figure it out, like figure out what you did know, what is real, what doesn't change. And I think that Wednesday and Sunday I spent with him every week, I think that was enough. I really do. One of the unfortunate results of divorce for the children of divorce is we can sometimes get lost in this feeling of, I don't have what other families have.
Yeah.
Or so-and-so isn't giving me what I should be getting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think so. Mm. I think you're getting what your soul needs in this lifetime. Mm-hmm. And maybe what you signed up for and didn't know that you did. I think we choose our parents. Mm-hmm. I think I cannot imagine my parents together for my whole childhood. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine it any other way than how I had it. Why should I have to carry the extra burden of, oh, but they didn't stay married? You know, it's like it's ridiculous. It's like, no, this is what I know. Yeah. This is what I had. My mom might feel, I wish it had been different, and that's okay, because she's my mother and she loves me.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I need to feel that way. I'm grateful for what I had. I'm grateful for the experience I had, and I'm going to celebrate it. And they were not meant to be together.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a beautiful way to look at it. And do you think that he did get to be fully himself when there was the freedom to not have to hide, like in the other days when he didn't have to be dad? Do you think he ever did really find the freedom to be his full expression?
Yes, I know he did, because my mom told me after his death that she had had a conversation with his girlfriend when he died, and he was straight, which probably added another component of it being confusing for him. Yeah, she told my mom that he was so happy when he was dressing and he got to go out and express this side of him. And that's really what it is for a straight man who's a crossdresser. They just have a gender fluidity and they need to I mean, I've researched a lot more since then. I've joined a support group for crossdressers. It's just part of how they're wired. It's how they're made. I think he experienced depression and frustration when he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because she said that too, he could be in bed for days if he couldn't. Mm. And I don't think that that is a shameful or too personal detail about him.
Yeah.
Because I think his spirit would be totally fine with me talking about this, because my feeling, and you know, who knows, if I die someday and go to heaven and find out I was wrong, then I was wrong. But I really do believe, given how compassionate he was, that he would be okay with me sharing this information because of the age we're living in.
Yeah.
And I think that talking about these things freely is, it just takes the power away from whatever taboo society wants to put on this stuff. It's just who he was, you know. It's no different than me talking about my depression or my ADHD, which at a time I did have shame about because it made me different or made me feel like I needed medication to function and therefore I'm somehow less than. And it's just nonsense.
I'm so glad you bring this up because I've struggled a lot. This is probably the first episode that I've talked about my father's abuse to my mom. And and I recently wrote a detailed essay about my father that shows him as a fully human, complex person. And I went to go submit it for possible publication. And I had a real hard time afterwards. I felt so like a bad daughter for, it's not out in the world yet. I don't know if it'll be chosen for a publication, but just submitting it, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm like thinking in my head, I went down to the ocean. I was trying to connect with my father. I closed my eyes. I was like, I feel bad in some ways revealing this side of you that maybe people didn't know about. And I don't want to dishonor your spirit. I do want to show you and us and everyone as fully human people. And this was one part. And the reason for even showing that was to show his growth as a human being later in life. And so I'm kind of spilling all this and I'm just going, I don't know. I feel nervous about the fact that I put that on the page. And this is what I hear back. It's an accurate portrayal. That's what I hear back. It's an accurate portrayal.
Yeah.
And that was it. And I was like, is it? Okay.
No, I mean, I'm happy. I'm really happy you brought that up though, because I was talking to someone the other day about one of my students. I teach a class at Modern Prairie, which is this app that helps women at midlife to reinvent themselves, basically. And
oh my gosh.
So I have to take, that's another thing that you could talk about is when you become a writer, what happens later? And I've managed to take my book and turn it into a class. One of my students started a podcast, so I went on her podcast. She had said something in the interview that later I was saying, oh, I wish I had said this in response to you. That didn't occur to me in the moment. And what she had said to me was, because I had mentioned, I felt like my dad's spirit was behind me the whole time I was doing the bucket list.
Yeah.
And he wasn't going to let me fail. And in the interview, what she said to me was, and you needed to do the bucket list so that you wouldn't let him down. And what I was saying to her after the fact was, oh, he didn't need me to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, like yeah. I wasn't going to let him down. Like I said, your life, your choices, you know,
yes.
Earlier, like this was my decision to do this. It was for my healing.
Yeah.
But I think you did your father a great service in writing that essay. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that doing my dad's bucket list was something I was doing for him, I think it was telling that true story.
Yeah.
I think it was giving him an accurate portrayal, at least from my eyes. You know, obviously we don't know all, so we can't tell the full truth. We can only tell our truth. But I did it with compassion and with a shared humanity. And I really think on the other side, once we pass, we can have some unfinished business here. And what a blessing if there's people here who still love us so much that they want to help us complete that unfinished business.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So well said. I could talk to you forever, but I will let you return back to your life. But I just hope you know how profound this was for me. I'm sure listeners will love it, but just to be able to speak to someone else who has lived a somewhat similar experience to mine, but has such wisdom around this has been huge for me. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm so glad. I hope if nothing else, what your listeners get out of this is how important it is to be authentic to who you are and live to the fullest. We just never know. I was given that gift at 25. It was a curse to me for so long, but now I understand it was a gift that ever since age 25, I've always told people I love them. I've always let people know how important they are. I've always considered every day could be my last.
Yeah.
And what a cool thing that my dad gave me that, just because now I get to live a really great life.
Yeah. Mm. Well, everyone will want to read your book. So tell everyone where to find you.
It's called My Father's List, How Living My Dad's Dream Set Me Free. And it's on bylaurakarney.com, B-Y, like a byline. Also Amazon, also Barnes & Noble, also, you know, most bookstores, you can find it.
Mm. Get it. You will not be disappointed. Thank you so much. I love this.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Whew. You see what I'm saying? It went so much deeper than I even anticipated this conversation going. And I'm so grateful. I'm always grateful when guests are willing to be really open, really transparent, really vulnerable. And that was certainly the case today. So thank you, dear listener, for being open and listening and coming back for each one of these episodes. I truly, truly appreciate your support. I write all the time over on Substack, so I hope that you will check me out there. The link is in the show notes. And many, many thanks to my dear producer, Michelle Rado, who is a miracle herself. She makes this show what it is. Remember, everyone, every heart has a story, and every story has a heart. See you next time.